Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Listening to The Economist Asks, I'm Anne McElvoy. My guest today is the German director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. He was just 33 when his first feature film, The Lives of Others, swept the board at the German and European Film Awards before taking home both the Oscar and BAFTA for Best Foreign Language Film in 2007. It seduced audiences with its story of the personal impact of Stasi surveillance in communist East Germany. After this precocious success, L.A. called. His second film was The Tourist, a glossy Hollywood caper with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. It didn't please all the critics, but it became a runaway hit, nominated for 3 Golden Globes and taking in over $270 million at the box office. Now, despite calling L.A. home, he's returned to his German roots and a fascination with the extremes of the 20th century. Never Look Away is a film closely based on the life of the artist Gerhard Richter.
Nie wegsehen, Gott. Alles, was war, ist schön.
It follows our young hero Kurt from his childhood in Dresden in the 1930s through the devastation of war into his afterlife in communist East Germany and then to the physical and creative freedom of escape to the West.
Das ist nicht die Erbmasse, die ich unseren Nachkommen wünsche.
Kann uns nicht einfach in Ruhe lassen?
Voraus.
But it also traces a dark secret, linking extremes of violence and love across 30 formative years of German history.
Sieh nicht weg.
Nicht wegsehen.
So this week we're asking, how does a renowned filmmaker today deal with the Third Reich in a new century? I came to an office in central London to talk to Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. Your film opens at the famous, infamous Entartete Kunst, Degenerate Art exhibition put on by the Nazis as a cautionary tale against progressive art. Tell us why you started there and how true to life you wanted to make that scene where we were immersed with these pictures.
I had been fascinated with that Degenerate Art exhibit and the absurdity of it from as long as I can remember. I mean, it's really a crazy thing to think that nothing that we show in that exhibit is exaggerated. All these paintings were there. All these painters were represented there. Goebbels had a team that he sent around all the German public museums and pulled out of there all the paintings that did not fit the Nazi ideal of art. And then he picked the ones that he considered the most ridiculous, the most despicable, and presented them to have people laugh at them. And it was a great success, that show. Over 2 million people came, which would be a hit show, you know, even by today's standards. And many people did come there to laugh about them, but also many people came because they knew it was the last chance to see great art. After this show was put on, it traveled through many different cities. The Nazis organized an impromptu auction in Switzerland that wasn't really well advertised, and there also wasn't that much money to go around. But what wasn't sold there was just burned. So we had to rebuild them, repaint them. We worked with painters and art historians and the archives of, for example, Otto Dix to recreate the big war cripples painting. There was only a little black and white photograph of it left, and so we went back to reports and chemical analyses and tried to find out what did it look like and recreated it. All that for just a little scene of not even 5 minutes at the beginning of the film, but I really felt like I was building just a monument to these artists whose work was treated so shamefully there.
The artist at the center of the film is Gerhard Richter.
It's inspired certainly by elements from his life, but it's a fictionalization.
What brought you to the figure of Gertrude in the first place.
The initial spark that he had created a beautiful painting based on a picture from his family album of his beautiful young aunt holding him as a little boy, and explained that this aunt had been murdered by the Nazis because she was schizophrenic. And this is a very haunting portrait to the world, but especially to Germans, because it gives a real face, and a beautiful one at that, to one of the completely forgotten victims of the NS crimes. Hundreds of thousands of people were murdered because they were considered genetically unfit. And of course, that number pales in comparison to what was done to people of Jewish background. And therefore, it's a forgotten crime, but it's yet another crime. It was really fascinating when a journalist from Der Tagesspiegel, when Richter was already in his 70s, found out that the woman that Gerhard Richter ended up marrying after the war was actually the daughter of a high-ranking SS doctor who had himself been in charge of large parts of this eugenics program. That was what fascinated me, just that premise that you can have, living under the same roof, within the same family, you know, a victim and a perpetrator, and using the fact that this perpetrator may have caused the actual trauma that propelled him to become an artist in the first place, and now can he use that art to unmask and destroy the perpetrator.
And the idea of victims, perpetrators living side by side has obviously fascinated you.
Yes.
In a film, old film of yours, The Lives of Others, with a former film we're going to come and talk about. But in this case, you'd have thought, well, this is relatively controversy-free. But it turns out not so much. And some people have found that going back to the Third Reich and making a film about it now has brought up sensitivities, haven't it, about the way that it looks, the way that it feels. Did you expect that?
As soon as you, I mean, I'm sure it's the same in your field in journalism, and I'm sure you've gotten into trouble of your own for things like that. As soon as you don't do things as the canon expects you to do it, as has been done before, you get in trouble. But it's mostly trouble that only lasts for a little while.
So explain that kind of trouble to me. You think, well, about critical, you know, response or Gerhard Richter's response? He wasn't too happy with the end film.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I had the same thing on The Lives of Others. You know, it's just, it was actually interesting when we were nominated for this film for Academy Awards. I was on several panel discussions with the other foreign language film directors, now they call them international film directors, and all these directors had the same story, that it's just, if something you know, becomes a little too big for a country that isn't America, you know, I mean, America is the only country that doesn't mind if things get big, you know.
But a lot of the sensibilities, and I, in a way, I hadn't expected this, so I watched the film and then I read a lot of the German sort of critics and essays around it, were, in a way, the sort of East Germany, perhaps because of East Germany disappeared, sort of one side kind of, in inverted commas, won. But in this case, where it's so big and the loss of life and the trauma was so great, that it seemed to almost, if you make it look a certain way, you were accused of some people making it look too beautiful, you were accused by some other people of stylizing violence.
Yeah. It's a natural human mechanism, and I don't, you know, I don't mind it. I've lived through it on The Lives of Others. There, I fretted about it more and got, like, really upset and angry if someone wrote this or that. And after a while, you just accept that, you know, no matter what you do, you will get attacked. The only way you don't get attacked is if you're constantly circumspect and scared and, oh, my goodness, what are people think? But then you have a miserable life and are most likely going to create miserable work.
And to get Gerhard Richter's response is, I don't like the film, I don't like the person,
no,
I assume
no.
he means you.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's hard,
the Gerhard
Richter,
well, no, I mean, you know, I suppose it's a certain type of portrait, the film, but, you know, you'd be a lousy artist if you made a portrait to, you know, flatter the, or please the person who's, or you're making a portrait of, or you're, if you're a super, super anxious, hyper-realistic painter, you know, if you're Franz Xaver Winterhalter, yes, then, you know, you're upset if the Queen doesn't like your portrait, and you're so happy when Queen Victoria says, oh, I've never looked more beautiful. But if you're Lucian Freud and you do a portrait of the Queen and she thinks, oh my goodness, I don't look that bad, and he says, well, look, that's how I see you, you know, who cares? That's not why I do it. I don't do it to be made CBE or something. Politeness is the death of art, and Gerhard Richter is someone who understands that very well. I mean, his art is the least polite you can imagine. He did a picture of a tourist being torn to shreds by a lion. Now, how do you think his that tourist family felt about that? You know, but he doesn't care, and rightly so, because it's part of art to hurt people, you know? I'll tell you one thing that I was most fascinated by the whole Gerhard Richter thing. It's not possible to involve someone more in a movie short of making it, you know, something authorized, like, you know, a polite picture about, you know, the band Queen making Brian May look really, really good and nice, or a heroic biopic about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, where everything is authorized by her, and you know, her only fault is just caring too damn much about women. I find that type of film terrible. It's still an incredible trick that Richter pulled. Being involved from every step, you know, I even went to, when I was done with the script, just so he wouldn't be surprised by anything, I went to read it to him. Every single step, we were in constant contact, and then making it appear as if this was somehow done against his will, I mean, that's just a PR genius, you know? Because, of course, how much cooler would it be if Brian May now said, you know what, you idiots, you don't know how cool our Queen life was. This doesn't even begin to tell the story. Piss off. That would be badass rock star, right? I mean, that would be impressive. And I think Richter knows that. So I think it was a little bit of that.
A bit confected. Let's talk a little bit more about the film, and then I'd just like to dive into what you feel more broadly. You've been reflecting in your work over the last 20 years or so. This exhibition, we meet our young hero, I think we can call him that within the context, Kurt, been taken to see the exhibition. The plot is going to wind on through the Third Reich and through its horrors as lived close at hand by this family, and the tension and also, in some senses, affinities between victims and perpetrators. And he doesn't seek revenge, or he doesn't seem really to seek revenge or even reckoning. Now, that's really interesting to me in a film, because the whole idea of so-called Vergangenheitsbewältigung, the conquering of the past, seemed, or coming to terms with the past, depending how you translate it, seemed to have this idea that justice should come. That's not the way you've gone here. And to an extent, the perpetrators get away with it.
I think that the perpetrators get destroyed in a more thorough way than if you threw them in prison in Spandau and allowed them to take some kind of sacrificial pose. I think they're punished by the artist taking away, in this case, this Nazi doctor's sense of identity, his sense of certainty. He completely underestimates this weakly, not particularly healthy, not particularly intelligent by IQ points son-in-law. And at the end of the day, he is the one who unmasks him, who shows him his true colors, who discovers it all. I think that shatters him in his sense of how the world works. I always find that it's, you know, an extreme victory for Kurt to, in a way, change him in that way. You know, I think not wanting the physical revenge, not wanting someone to come and carve a swastika into his forehead, you know, and all that, as, say, Quentin Tarantino would do it, comes from somehow looking at history and realizing that that's not how it goes down. People do manage to escape. The very abilities that allow these terrible people to rise to the top in a monstrous regime like the Nazi regime will allow them to survive in the next regime. They have a kind of survival instinct, and it is, of course, it's great if there are people who bring them to justice, but we cannot let them win by letting it destroy our lives that we have not managed to bring them to justice. And, you know, I was almost there a little bit as a child, because, so I was 8 years old when we returned from New York to Berlin.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your own family. Obviously, you're deeply rooted in German history, big German family name. You lived outside as a small child, but so you came back at eight.
At age eight, it was something, that was the first time that we really got, you know, became confronted with the Nazi history. And to a child at that age, it seems, you know, unthinkable. But we lived in Berlin, and we saw this, the wall every day walking to school. And then you start asking questions. What's this wall? Why this separation? You know, and it quickly gets you back to those Nazi chapters, which led to all this. you know, if I had lived my life backwards from 1973, I'd be well outside of World War II by now. It is all pretty recent. And one thing that I really internalized was that Kohl's idea, where he said, you know, we are so lucky that we were born late, die Gnade der späten Geburt, the grace
this
of
the
late
German
birth.
This is the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl.
Former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. I remember my grandparents saying, you know what, it's not true. It's not that by some wonderful coincidence we happen not to become murderers and violators of human rights and so on. The people who were monsters between 1933 and 1945 were monsters before 33 and remained monsters after 45. And once you've kind of understood that, it gives you a different way of looking at the world. When there was a teacher who behaved terribly in school and he was old, we automatically, our minds went there. What did this guy do during the Nazi age? How did he behave towards Jewish students? You know, if there was a hint of that, and it's not a healthy way of looking at the world, because you get into a kind of revenge mode. And I think that the best revenge is by, it's not so much of the, you know, kind of living well, that seems so materialistic, but living the things that people who do the bad stuff cannot live. Love, friendship, understanding, you know, tolerance. These are all things that give us great joy. They don't have that.
Let's talk about the other regime on German soil in the late 20th century, which still leaves its traces in the Germany today. And it's a shared interest that we both have, and that's the old East Germany.
You've written about it extensively. Yeah.
I have, yes. Yeah. And I think we established at one point that we had researched at around the same time,
yes,
possibly in the
Bidler archives also,
At the Humboldt. Yeah, I was at the Humboldt 1986 to 87.
Yeah, yeah.
That's obviously the year. I'd like to think it was just because I was there, but unfortunately it wasn't, when you set your very famous film, The Lives of Others. And there are obviously, there are so many differences, but clearly there are commonalities. It's interesting that you started with the later regime and went back to the Third Reich. Do you think there were reasons for that, other than just your own filmography and what you were interested in?
Well, I kind of hoped that I would be the one German filmmaker who would never make a film that touched the Third Reich, because it's just something that has been, in a way, done to death, and it seems like you've seen every facet of it. But you know, it's about maybe a quarter or so of this movie is set in the Third Reich, because it was necessary to explain how things happened. I mean, it was a seminal moment in German history, and anybody who tries to make it seem any less than that is just wrong, because it's something that we live with on a daily basis in Germany. You cannot spend a day without being reminded in all consequences of the war, of the crimes, of the incredible guilt that Germany heaped upon itself. And it had to be, you know, this is a journey of healing, self-healing of one artist. You have to address that.
Does that still apply in the same way? And your film was, I think, really a seismic event in the treatment of the old East Germany. In a way, I had left there a couple of years after unification, and there was a feeling of let bygones be bygones, let people who are affected go and sort of rootle around in the Stasi archives. Well, let's not. Do we have to keep stirring it up? And we heard this a lot, not surprisingly, from East Germans, but perhaps from society as a whole. And I think your film really changed that. Do you think it had a lasting effect? And when you look now and go back to your home country, do you still see those traces of division, or do you think this is really a post-war world as well as a post-war one?
It's hard for me to answer, because, I mean, Germany has now has such a whole new set of problems, and its identity has been changed so massively over the past years that maybe these issues are not so much on the forefront. But I do think that, for example, the fact that Germany, for instance, took in these millions of fugitives, immigrants, had very directly to do, obviously, with the Nazi regime. I mean, there would be no other.
This is Angela Merkel in 2016,
and the big wave of
refugees.
And it has also very much to do with atoning for a guilt and saying, you know, Germany has to be a place that anyone can flee, and going so far as to say, if it changes the country and fundamentally changes the identity, where is the harm in that? Because the country still hasn't reconciled itself with its identity. That, I think, is my view of what the view of the country in its totality is.
Some people would say, and not only those arguing on a sort of anti-immigration right-wing platform, that it has caused considerable difficulties for Germany and may still do so in terms of a backlash.
The immigrant crisis was and is an opportunity for Europe to prove itself as a political entity. The European Union was founded in large part to prevent Germany from acting on its own, by itself. And now, in the first major crisis that Europe faces, Germany, represented by one leader, does exactly that, ignores all these massive alliances that have been forged and does something completely by itself, thereby massively destabilizing the European cohesion. I mean, you know, it's not very far-fetched to say that even the British reaction has to do with the immigration situation. I think if it had been approached as a European thing, Europe could have become much stronger, as it is, because of Germany having this thing of thinking that we always know best. And even here, we were so much more humanitarian, we're so much better, we're so much... You know, the mistake, I think, in Germany is believing that if a new political extreme crisis comes about, it'll look exactly like the old one.
Florian Hengel von Donnersmarck, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Anne. It was great speaking with you, as always.
And we'd love to know what you think. Can filmmakers take liberties with the historical record? And does great art always come from great trauma? Write to us, radio@economist.com, or you can tweet us at Economist Radio. You can also subscribe at economist.com/radio offer, 12 issues for £12 or $12. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.